I just forgot. The FBI, Cassie. The FBI! What did they ask you? What did they ask Dennis? She saw that Enrico was watching her. He looked concerned. They wanted to know what the hell kind of relationship you have with my husband. They wanted to know if you've ever discussed money problems with me, with him, with us. They wanted to know if you've been acting weird lately, or ever. They wanted to know how much you drink. I could go on. Then do. They wanted to know if we ever saw you with strange people, or with this Alex Sokolov person, the one who was killed. I guess, like you, he lived in New York. They wanted to know any stories you shared from Dubai, or Europe, traveling stories. What did you tell them?
I told them you don't have any relationship with Dennis, except he's your brother-in-law.
At first, I thought they were implying you two were having some sort of really icky affair, and maybe they were, but that wasn't it. At least, that wasn't the main thing. We're not. He loves you. I love you. They were digging for something else. It was like they thought he was telling you things about work he's not supposed to tell anyone. I promise you, I wouldn't understand a word.
I don't think that was their point, Cassie.
You know what he does is classified. He's in the chemical corps, for God's sakes. What else did you tell them? Rosemary blew her nose. Cassie realized that as angry as her sister was, she was also scared. She'd likely been crying before she had phoned. There was far more terror than truculence in her tone.
I told them you drink too much, but you're not, as far as I can tell, as irresponsible as our father. I told them I know nothing about any strange people in your life because I don't know any of your friends or boyfriends. When I told them that, I think it sounded suspicious, but mostly it just made me sad. It dawned on me that I know nothing about your world except the sense that you travel to cool places and you bring my children sweet gifts.
Cassie wanted to lash out, to say something defensive about the fact it was really Rosemary who kept her at bay. But her sister was already so upset, and Cassie knew that it was her fault that Rosemary was being dragged into her nightmare, and so she didn't respond. Instead, she inquired only, "Is that the sort of thing they asked Dennis to?"
"I don't know. He was at the base and couldn't talk, but I suppose so. They brought him to some conference room and just kept grilling him."
"Well, it sounds like he had nothing to hide."
"Nothing to hide? Dennis's work involves chemical weapons. You think he's just some goofy engineer geek, but that geek spends his days getting rid of our sarin and VX and some of the scariest stuff in our arsenal."
"I know.
I mean, he's got a very high security clearance."
"I get it," Cassie said softly.
"And now the FBI is interviewing him."
"But he hasn't done anything wrong."
"I know that. You know that. But it's just..."
"It's just what?"
"It just looks bad. It just looks terrible."
"I'm sorry," Cassie murmured. "I am." Her sister ignored her apology.
"They wanted to know what you told me about this man who was killed. I told them the truth. You'd never even mentioned the guy because you never mention any of the legions you sleep with."
"It isn't legions, Rosemary. Come on.
What am I supposed to tell Jessica and Tim?"
"I gather you don't think they'll be especially proud of their aunt?"
"Cassie, I love you. I really do. But what the hell have you done? This is different. I'm scared for my husband, and I'm scared for my children. Tell me what sort of trouble you're in."
"I've done nothing," she said. She told herself this wasn't lying. This was staying on message. "I spent the night with an interesting man in Dubai. When I left, he was still alive. After that, I have no idea what happened."
"Except we do have an idea," her sister said. "Someone practically cut off his head. And as for him being interesting, I have a feeling the FBI would use a very, very different adjective."
The front door was unlocked,
and Enrico led them into the apartment without knocking. They walked through the dark, immaculate living room and kitchen, and out onto the terrace. His uncle was in a white dress shirt and light blue suit pants, no necktie, sipping Cointreau neat on the private terrace and reading the newspaper beneath a small pergola. His suit jacket was draped over the back of his chair. The terrace had a 4-foot-high fountain with a goddess holding a pitcher, and 2 raised beds with tomato plants. There were lemon trees. It was a lovely private oasis in the middle of a city. Cassie guessed that Piero Bianchi was in his mid-40s, and when he stood to greet her, she detected a wisp of verbena. He was Enrico's mother's youngest brother, and he worked for a bank. He was trim, like his nephew, but his hair had receded, and what was left was more salt than pepper. Still, Cassie found the reality that she was much closer to Piero's age than to Enrico's disconcerting. Enrico had texted his uncle to make sure he was home, but he hadn't said why they were coming. He had told Cassie that she was not to bring up the gun or say a word about it. He'd said firmly that he would take care of it.
"And you're a flight attendant,"
Piero said when they were settled around the table. His accent was almost non-existent.
"I have friends who fly for Alitalia and American."
"Pilots? Flight attendants?"
"Both, but mostly the latter."
"I like the lifestyle."
"As do they. You're sure I can't get you two something to drink?"
"No, I'm fine," she said. She looked at Enrico, and he shook his head, too.
"Where is your base?"
"JFK."
"Among my least favorite airports in the world. It's a dinosaur."
"It really is." Abruptly, Enrico stood up and said he was going to the bathroom.
"So, tell me, how did you meet my nephew?"
"The airline was staying at his hotel. He made me an excellent Negroni."
"I'm not surprised. Someday soon, I believe, I will be bankrolling a bar for him. A restaurant and bar. First, however, he needs a partner who can cook."
"Can you cook?"
"My refrigerator is nothing but leftover Indian food and yogurt that's gone bad."
"I am guessing that means no."
"A very good guess." He finished the last of the Cointreau. She stared at the empty glass when he put it down, and she had a feeling that her longing was so powerful that Piero could sense it.
"Enrico's a good boy," he said,
and Cassie couldn't miss the way he had used the word boy. She couldn't decide whether he was chastising her or teasing her, giving her a little good-natured grief, or merely referring to his nephew the way any uncle would, even when the child was a grown man.
"He is," she agreed simply.
"When he said he had someone he wanted me to meet, I was expecting something different."
"Something younger?"
He gave a loud, reflexive laugh.
"No, Italian."
"Really?"
"Of course not. I'm kidding. I don't know why, but I heard something in his voice when he called that led me to believe he wanted to tell me something important. And I was thinking this was it. I am about to meet a person who does something exquisite with wild boar or scallops or zucchini. And he wanted to start a restaurant with him or her."
"Sorry."
"Good heavens. Why should you be sorry?"
"I'm not that person." "You sounded disappointed."
"Not at all. But I am still trying to understand why he wanted me to meet you. Are you two dating?"
"No, we're just friends."
"Well, now, that does surprise me. Even if you weren't dating, I assumed there was more to the relationship than friendship. I know my nephew's hobbies well."
"Maybe in another life."
"Maybe."
A moment later, Enrico returned. She noticed that he had untucked his shirt. He smiled at her, leaned forward, and pretended to scratch his lower back. She glanced there and saw that he was pulling tight his shirt with his thumb and forefinger, so she could see the outline of the grip of the pistol he had slid into the back of his jeans.
Chapter 29. Elena watched Cassie and Enrico emerge from the apartment's front entrance. The bartender's uncle stood for a long moment in the doorway beneath an overhead exterior light, the glass amber as the couple strolled away from him down the street. He didn't wave because their backs were turned, and his shoulders were stooped and he looked a little sad. She wondered why. She tried to decide why Enrico had brought the flight attendant here. If he wanted to introduce her to his family, he would have brought her first to his parents, not to his uncle. She hadn't needed any clandestine tools to research Piero Bianchi while she waited for them to emerge. She only wanted the basics. She learned he was a banker, though he didn't seem to have much to do with foreign currencies or hedge funds or international banking. Mostly, he financed local real estate, new commercial construction inside the Roman Ring. This was comforting, though not conclusive. After all, much of the fund Sokolov ran was in real estate. It was possible that the manager had told Bowden something about his day job, and Bowden had told the bartender, and the two of them had now gone to Uncle Piero for a tutorial. Any banker with Piero's experience could answer basic investment questions or explain the bare bones of what Sokolov did at Unisphere. But if Bowden had questions, she'd had plenty of opportunities to talk to bankers while she was home in Manhattan. Wouldn't that lawyer of hers have been tracking them down? Wouldn't Bowden have gone to speak to someone in America instead of going to the animal shelter or the zoo or hooking up with that actor? No, Elena decided. The two of them had gone to see Uncle Piero for some reason that had absolutely nothing to do with the hedge fund. She thought of something her father had told her. A smart girl is nobody's pushover and nobody's foe. A smart girl is both sword and smile. At the time, she had considered countering that his ex-wife was all sword and seemed to do just fine, thank you very much, but she understood his message. Her handler in Abu Dhabi had postulated a theory to explain the connection between Sokolov and Bowden. "Is it possible that this flight attendant is actually a whole lot smarter than the average bear?" he'd asked her. Maybe she was working with Sokolov on the grift the whole time and their inebriated debacle was a hoax. "Play this out," she'd said to him. "Okay, Bowden isn't even in the room when you phoned 511. She got there just before you did, and she and Sokolov concocted the ruse when they were caught. They portrayed their meeting as just some drunken debauch." "No, they were wasted," she assured him. "They weren't play-acting." She told him her theory in return. Bowden had said something on the plane about what her brother-in-law did for a living, and Sokolov saw an opportunity. Here was a flight attendant who flew regularly into the United Arab Emirates, and she had a brother-in-law who was a major at an army base that was awash in chemical weapons. He was a destruction engineer. Perhaps the flight attendant could help them enlist or blackmail him. But Victor already had his own asset inside the chemical weapons program. The FSB had their own courier with the airline. They didn't need her. The irony, of course, was that back in the United States, the FBI now had to investigate Major McCulley, make sure that he hadn't violated his security clearance and told his sister-in-law something she might have shared with Sokolov. So they were talking to him. They were talking to his family. Meanwhile, Victor probably suspected, no, assumed, that the flight attendant was either FBI and she was interested in Sokolov, or she was CIA and hoping to use Sokolov to get inside the Cossacks. And even if she weren't, she'd still been in the suite. She may have been merely a sexually voracious flight attendant in the wrong place at the wrong time, but she may also have been something rather more dangerous. And so Victor, fully and rightly, expected that his redoubtable protege would have killed the woman when she found her in the room. But she hadn't. Since Dubai, Victor had been telling her they were worried that the flight attendant might reveal something compromising that Sokolov had shared while drunk. They had stressed that the flight attendant had seen her and thus could easily burn her. Certainly the crazy woman had recognized her at Fiumicino. So these were her fears, too. But there was something else going on, and it was now coming into focus. She had not merely failed Victor by neither executing Bowden nor telling him initially that the woman had been in the room. She had irrevocably compromised his faith in her, their faith in her, their trust. They thought she had quite possibly spared an FBI asset or an actual agent. They'd never believe her, no matter how eloquently she explained the truth of what she knew or how many synonyms she found in English or Russian for the noun drunk. They'd figured out that she was CIA. They'd figured out that she had turned. spies, and she always felt self-important and narcissistic when she thought of herself that way, but it was better than the alternative words, which stressed the more lethal aspects to her work, turned for a lot of reasons. Most of the time, it was because they hadn't a choice. They'd been compromised or were being blackmailed, and changing teams was the only play to keep out of prison, or in some cases, to stay alive. The rationale for her turn in America had origins both prosaic and profound. Yes, once she was ensconced in Boston, she could see more objectively the corruption that had spread plague-like in the new Russia, and she refused to succumb to that unique hybrid of fatalism and cynicism that marked her people. She wanted her new Russia to be better than the old one, and that meant undermining the old guard. But that alone wouldn't have been enough. There was also a man, a grad student 5 years her senior, an American. She was 24, a young FSB agent. She would never know if the courtship had been recruitment all along, because in hindsight, it never had been much of a romance. He'd been clear that they really couldn't be seen together in the event one or the other ever was outed. But he was the one who broke the news to her that her father had not had a stroke when she was 20. They'd poisoned him with methyl iodide, selecting the pesticide because the cause of death would mimic a stroke. The Cossacks had done this. Viktor Olenin. In his old age, her father was becoming too outspoken and too critical of the president of the Russian Federation. He was becoming a liability, a loose cannon. He knew too much to live. But he had lived, despite the toxin, barely. Now that young man was a poli-sci professor in Berlin. Elena stopped visiting his public persona on the social networks when she saw that his German girlfriend had become his German wife. She sighed. She wondered if Victor's trust in her had begun to ebb even before she had chosen not to kill the flight attendant. If so, when had they come to doubt her devotion, her fealty? It didn't matter. What did was this. They believed she had spared Bowdoin for reasons far worse than mere kindness. It was possible they might kill her even if she did take care of the flight attendant, or, to be precise, as soon as she'd taken care of the flight attendant. And yet, when she surveyed the chessboard, executing the woman still seemed a viable move for everyone. She'd expressed her concerns to her handler, and Washington was deliberating whether it was time to come in. But she was, far and away, their most deeply embedded operative in the Cossacks, the only one inside the group who could tell them what Olenin was doing. And that mattered. And she felt a tug in her heart for Saatchi. It was in her blood, her DNA. She wasn't prepared to give that up. Not yet. Her father, as far as she knew, had never had a safe house, an apartment in Amsterdam or a cottage outside Johannesburg into which he could burrow. A secret chrysalis with food and money and yet one more passport, and from which she could emerge with new wings and a new identity. But just because she wasn't aware of one didn't mean that one hadn't existed. You never told your loved ones you had one. It was how you protected them. She herself had never set one up, and she couldn't help now but wonder if this bit of youthful hubris, "I'll never need one, I'm too smart and I have too many friends in high places," wasn't now going to bite her in the ass. She followed the bartender and the flight attendant at a careful distance. It was twilight, which was an easier time of the day to tail someone. Moreover, there were tourists and dinner crowds in this neighborhood, and she could blend in should Bowdoin suddenly turn around. But then, it was unlikely the woman would recognize her with her new hair color. She'd dyed it specifically because she couldn't risk a repeat of what had happened that morning at the airport. She noticed that the couple wasn't touching as they walked, though it was still possible that they were returning to her hotel. Instead of cutting back through the Villa Borghese, however, they were strolling along the Via de Villa Rolfo, and so she assumed they would stop at a restaurant on the way. Because they were dawdling, she had to dawdle, which meant that she also had to endure the occasional whistles and come-ons from young men as they passed on the sidewalk or as they drove by, slowing on the street on their colorful Vespas. She smiled at the men whose remarks were less offensive because it was important not to make a scene, and she ignored the others. It was in the Piazza del Popolo, As the bartender and the flight attendant passed a waist-high black fence with a beautiful cycloid of wrought iron arches and neared the great obelisk in the center of the park, that she figured out why Enrico had brought Bowden to his uncle's. Piero had a little place in the country, in Tuscany. No doubt the fellow had a hunting permit, perhaps even a concealed carry license. His nephew had brought the flight attendant to his uncle's apartment to get the woman a gun.
Chapter 30.
So, you're really not going to allow me to make you one of my perfect Negronis?
Enrico asked her as they entered the lobby of the hotel where she was staying. Instinctively, she looked around to see if any members of the flight crew were present. None were. The lobby was so small compared to the Royal Phoenician, more living room than ballroom, the ceilings low and the decor modest. She noted the faux Renaissance tapestries on the walls and the fainting couch where she had sat that afternoon.
"I'm not," she said, though she glanced longingly at the bar as they approached the elevators, her ears alive to the clink of glasses and laughter, and the music that occasionally bubbled up and over the bacchanal. They had eaten dinner at a romantic trattoria with brick walls and lit candles and wrought iron chandeliers where he was friends with the sous-chef, and so they ate like royalty for almost nothing, which was about what they had for a budget. She had never had a panzanella salad so good, each tomato a different shade of orange or red. The house wines were excellent, Enrico told her, but Cassie insisted that she wasn't going to drink, and so Enrico didn't either. She sat with her back to the wall and sipped sparkling water and stared at the entrance to the restaurant. She wasn't sure what she was looking for. She wasn't sure who she was looking for. She didn't honestly believe that Miranda, or someone, would appear in the dining room. But after Fiumicino, she wasn't willing to sit with her back to the door. It had been a lovely evening. Though it had been, and she told herself, would be, almost stoic in its denial. No booze, no sex. She was bringing him upstairs to her room so he could hand her the gun. The fact was that she knew more about firearms than he did. But he didn't dare bring out the Beretta at the restaurant, and so they had agreed they would retreat to her hotel room so he could give it to her there. She'd been clear that they weren't going to have sex, but she knew that he nevertheless remained hopeful. He was charming beyond his years. He was as unaccustomed to someone saying no as she was to saying it. When they got to her room, she saw that the square red light on the desk phone was blinking. Instantly, her anxiety rose. Enrico stood patiently by the window, his back to her as he stood, bordered by the drapes, while she picked up the receiver and listened. It turned out that she had two messages.
"Hey there, it's Michaela. I'm just checking in. How did I not think to get your cell? I wanted to make sure you're okay. Do you still want to have that drink? Do you feel up to joining some of us for dinner, maybe? I'm in room 713. It's a little before 5. She made a mental note of the other flight attendant's room number and then listened to the second message. "Hi, Cassie, it's me again, Michaela. Some of us are meeting in the lobby at 7:30. Join us if you'd like. No pressure. Maybe text me when you wake up or get back from wherever you are," she said, and this time she left her cell number. Cassie wrote it down and texted back that she was sorry she hadn't gotten the messages. She wrote that she had gone for a long walk, but now she was back in her hotel room and she was fine. She was in for the night. She thanked her.
"Everything is okay?" asked Enrico.
"It is. That was just another member of the crew wanting to be reassured that I was safely back in my room."
"Good."
He picked up the paperback Tolstoy on the nightstand beside the hotel's digital clock.
"Did you ever read Carlo Levi?"
"No."
"You should, if you like Tolstoy. He wrote beautifully about Italian peasants. My people, once. He had a soul like Tolstoy. The future has an ancient heart. I think I have that right.
Thank you. I don't expect I'll find him with the paperbacks at the airport.
Look for him when you're home, he said.
And somehow his tone made the idea of home sound to her like an unattainable dream, a port she would not see again. Still, Enrico smiled and sat on the foot of the bed. He patted the mattress beside him, beckoning her. The bed was the unmade mess she had left it after her afternoon nap. She joined him there, and he pulled out the handgun. He gave it to her, and then reached into his front pants pocket for the bullets. The gun was heavier than she expected, but she liked its simple solidity, its heft. It actually felt sturdier than a rifle. And the smell, metallic, machine-like, instantly brought her back to the high school classroom those early autumn afternoons when she had taken the hunter safety course and been taught by a retired state trooper the three different types of magazines. Tubular, box, floor plate with a hinge, and where the gunpowder sits inside a cartridge. Then she was back in the woods, with a whole other set of memories. The aroma of autumnal cold, wet leaves as they began to merge with the mud, decomposing trees, damp clothes. She thought of her father's breath, beery, when he would point out the deer tracks in the soft earth, or the deer scat in the midst of the leaves just off the thin path. The Beretta was a compact 92, all black. She ejected the magazine to make sure it was empty. She racked back the chamber to make sure there was no bullet in there either.
"The bullets are so little," Enrico said.
He poured four of them into her hand and rolled a fifth between his forefinger and thumb. She took it from him.
"The gun will hold all five of them?"
She examined the magazine. "Yes. This magazine probably holds three times that many rounds." He shook his head.
"I should have stolen more bullets."
"God, no." Loading the magazine, she thought, was like loading a Pez candy dispenser, one little sugar brick at a time. When she had the cartridges inside the clip, she used the heel of her hand to tap the clip back into the handle. She hoped she had done everything right. Then she placed it on the nightstand next to the telephone. She didn't want to get comfortable with the grip while he was there beside her on the bed. She wanted to do that when she was alone.
"So what do we do now?" he asked.
They had bought a large metal tin of Perugia chocolates on the way back to the hotel. The plan was that in the morning, when she and the rest of the flight crew checked out, she was going to leave the tin for him with a friend of his who was scheduled to be manning the reception desk. The gun would be at the bottom, unloaded, beneath the chocolates. "I'm going to thank you and escort you to the door."
"And eat the chocolates?"
She smiled at him. He was adorable. The perfect toy. "I'll make a dent in the box, maybe. There has to be room for the gun, right?"
"And you'll try to get some sleep?" he asked.
"I guess. If someone wanted to kill me, they had every chance this afternoon and this evening." He took her hand in both of his and gazed at her. His eyes looked sleepy in the hotel room light.
"But you're scared. You wanted a gun."
"I'm a heck of a lot less scared now."
"But tomorrow? And the day after tomorrow? And the day after that? What is your plan?"
She lifted his fingers to her mouth and kissed them once. Then she kissed them a second time. "I don't have a plan," she answered. "I wish I did, but I don't." The truth was, she had been living almost hour to hour since she had woken up in Dubai and found Alex Sokolov dead. First, she just wanted to get away from the corpse and the likelihood of prison and reach Charles de Gaulle. Then she just wanted to land in America. Then she just wanted to find a lawyer. Then she just wanted to survive the FBI. Then. But she couldn't tell him any of that because Enrico believed, or at least was pretending to believe, that Alex Sokolov had been alive when she had left the hotel room.
Well, I have a plan, he said, his eyebrows raised, his face playful. She shook her head.
I'm not thinking what you think I am, he said.
You're thinking you're so handsome that I'm going to fall under your spell. Well, you are that handsome, and I am under your spell. But I'm trying to do better, to be better. So please don't tempt me any more, because I'm really not known for my willpower.
No, I'm thinking that we turn on the TV and play video games or watch movies. I'm thinking that I call downstairs for a pot of coffee, for me.
I can't allow that. I told you, I don't want you to take that risk.
Can I tell you something?
Of course.
I already talked to security. I told them the cart tart killer is staying here, and newspaper and TV people might try to sneak upstairs. They are going to be extra watchful in the lobby.
She sat back and appraised him. Wow, you're good.
You're impressed?
I am. He picked up the gun and held it by the grip.
And we have this. If we stay together and watch TV and play games, there's no one in the world who can hurt us tonight.
She took the gun from him. She worried that he might accidentally discharge it. I wish that were true. But it's not. Then she stood and with her free hand led him to his feet. She walked him to the door. The chocolate box will be downstairs in the morning with your uncle's Beretta, she told him.
Text me, he said.
I will.
And I will see you next week?
Yes, absolutely, she said, though she didn't believe it. She had a feeling she'd never see him again. Then she kissed him chastely on the cheek, thanked him once more, and said good night. When he was gone, she thought of what her lawyer had suggested, and deadbolted the door. After he had left, she sat in the chair and turned so she was facing the door, and practiced holding the Beretta with two hands. She closed one eye and stared through the sight, aiming at the peephole in the door one moment and at the handle the next. She flipped the safety on and off. It was late here in Rome, but nearing dinner time in Manhattan. She texted Ani to see if there was news. Ani texted back that there wasn't. She texted her sister that she was sorry she had caused her so much worry. Not just now, but over the years. And she told her she loved her. She texted her friend Jillian to thank her for all of the time she had brought her home and held back her hair while she vomited into the toilet. No, toilets, plural. There had been toilets and bars, toilets and clubs, toilets in other people's homes. She texted Paula to keep her shirt on, a joke they shared about how impatiently they drank when they were together, and how one or the other would often wind up with her shirt off those nights. Cassie recalled holding back Paula's hair exactly the way Jillian had held back hers. She texted Megan to please wave to the Brandenburg gate for her. She added how much she had always enjoyed flying with her. She put the words filet mignon with a hashtag after the text, a reference to the time that Megan was serving a particularly despicable, angry boar in first class. He had knocked his entree, the filet mignon, onto the cabin floor and complained bitterly as if it were Megan's fault. She had told him with a sincere smile, "Good thing we have extras." Then she had brought the piece of meat to the lav, rinsed it off with the undrinkable water there, reheated it, and returned it to him on his plate. And she texted Buckley the answer to his most recent question. What's the difference between a Pop-Tart and a cart tart? They're both sweet, and they both get toasted. But a cart tart's not nearly as good for you. She hoped her small joke would make him smile, but the truth of it made her cringe. It wasn't merely the acknowledgement of her drinking. It was the reality that she was poisonous. She always risked diminishing the people she loved, or might someday love. Too often she forced them to make the same bad choices she did, or she forced them from her life.
best case, she forced them to care for her. Today, though sober, she had gotten a kind young man to steal a gun from his uncle for her. She had needed Michaela to bring her to the hotel after she was pepper sprayed. And she had attacked a strange woman at an international airport. She wrote Buckley a second text. When I sent you that text, above, I meant it as a joke. But you need to know, Buckley, that it's true, too. It's the truest thing I have ever said. I'm not good for you. I'm not good for anyone. It's not just the lies or the fact I'm a drunk. It's who I am. It's what I am. So, don't ever wait for me. Don't expect anything of me. I will only disappoint you, and I know you deserve better. And that also is true. Would he understand this was goodbye? Perhaps not. But he would when she ignored his next text, and the text after that, either because she was doing what was right or because she was dead. Finally, she turned on the television and found the stations from America. She sat against the headboard with a handgun beside her and watched an old sitcom about brilliant young physicists who were socially awkward. She was going to watch anything but the news. She was just starting to doze off when she was awakened by the deafening, shrill, high-pitched wail of the hotel fire alarm.
Chapter 31. Who really burned most of Moscow to the ground in 1812? Tolstoy seemed to believe it was the occupying French army, and it was an accident. Too many soldiers starting too many fires. Myriad small blazes igniting one massive one that drove Napoleon from the Kremlin, though only briefly. He would return and reside there a month before the long French retreat would commence. But Elena knew that her father and her father's friends thought otherwise. The Russians themselves, the few that remained in the city, set torch to the wooden buildings. Hadn't the Russian commander himself demobilized the firefighting corps? Hadn't he ordered that the firefighting wagons be wrecked? No one would ever know for sure where on the spectrum the inferno fell between suicide and sabotage, but Elena had grown up confident that it was the Muscovites themselves, citizens and soldiers alike, who had destroyed the great city. Which, in her mind, fit the Russian character to a T. She saw herself in the light from those flames. She knew her people, and she knew the way the West looked down on them. Certainly the West had in 1812, and certainly the West did today. Hadn't she felt that when she had been a student in Switzerland and Massachusetts? Hadn't she heard that in the derogatory comments in political science classes about serfs and gulags and oligarchs? Well, North Americans had their crimes too. Genocide and slavery and, yes, oligarchs of their own. So be it. She and her ancestors lived with a chip on their shoulders that made them at once defiant and fatalistic, and conquerable only by themselves. Always it had been Russians themselves who, in the end, vanquished or annihilated or finally broke Russians. She was considerably more frightened of Victor than she was of any man or woman she had ever met in the West. Her mind, as it did often now, meandered to Sochi and her father's dacha there, her home there. Mostly it had been spared the madness of the Olympic construction, but the view of the mountains to the southwest had changed. You could see roads that had been cut through the forest in the distance, and in the winter you could spot the alpine trails that had been added when there was snow. Her father would have been appalled had he lived to see it, but the vista to the east was unchanged, as rustic and primeval as when Stalin had summered nearby. And she had a sense that despite his disappointment, her father would have adapted. Perhaps he would have grown accustomed to sitting on the porch on the eastern side of the house instead of the one on the west, and arranged his days so he could bask in the sunrises instead of the sunsets. You didn't survive in the Soviet Union if you didn't adapt. You didn't thrive in the post-Soviet world if you weren't a chameleon. Certainly her father was, but he was also a realist and he was disciplined. It was one more reason why she both respected and loved him. And he was Russian. Unconquerable by forces from beyond the border. the only person who had ever defeated him was his equally Russian wife. She read the message from Washington twice to be sure, then a third time. There was no ambiguity. She was done. Finished. They agreed with her. The Cossacks knew she'd been turned. Inside, she was an uncharacteristic riot of emotions. There was, and it pained her to admit this, because she liked to believe that she was above an emotion as pedestrian as fear, relief. Because she herself was evidence of Victor's brutality toward his enemies, she knew what loomed for her. But there was also shame, because she felt like a failure. She had failed the agency, yes, but more than that, she had failed her father. She did what she did to fuck Victor, and there were other discordant, confusing waves that broke over her, too, all of which began and ended with the unexpected fog that was her future. Her orders were to get the flight attendant and get out. She was to get the two of them out. She'd go ahead and pull the fire alarm as she had planned, because she suspected that Bowden had a gun, and she didn't really want the woman to shoot her the moment she walked into her hotel room. But the rest of her evening was going to be rather different. So be it. How funny that she'd just been thinking about her beloved Sachi. She felt a pang in her heart, knowing she'd never see Russia again. Elena understood that the blue dot on her phone could tell her more or less where the flight attendant was when it came to a street address, but it certainly couldn't confirm whether the woman had left her hotel room. The frog's heart was going to beat at this address, but it could not discern whether she was outside on the street or ensconced upstairs in her room. And so she pulled the fire alarm on Cassandra Bowden's floor, but along a different corridor. Then she went quickly to the flight attendant's hallway and watched, occasionally moving with the herd as the guests emerged, hoping to blend in by looking as frazzled and as sleepy as they. She was wearing a nondescript black hoodie and sweatpants. It seemed as if most of the guests presumed this was either a drill or a false alarm, but she noted how most were obediently, albeit begrudgingly, taking the stairs rather than the elevators to the lobby and exiting the hotel. Most had climbed back into their clothes, though none were as well dressed as they would have been just a few hours earlier. She saw women and men in blue jeans and sweatpants like her, their shirts untucked, their sneakers or shoes barely tied. She saw flip-flops. She saw women without makeup and men with their hair wild with sleep. She noted the couples who had clearly been having sex when they were interrupted. The evidence, the way they looked at once, sheepish and annoyed and clung a little hungrily to each other. She saw three children, all girls, and supposed they were sisters. The youngest was only 3 or 4 and was in her father's arms, using her fists to wipe at her eyes. And she saw Bowden. There she was, alone. She was still dressed in the sundress she had worn to dinner with the bartender, but the bartender wasn't with her. She couldn't decide what that meant, but it would make her job easier. The flight attendant had slipped on her sandals. She had with her a shoulder bag, which Elena was quite sure now held a gun. This time, the woman hadn't noticed her. There would be no repeat of the madness that morning at Fiumicino. It was then that her phone buzzed, and she saw it was Victor. She didn't dare ignore Victor, even now. So she took her phone and retreated into the stairwell, secure in the knowledge that Bowden was gone. Yes? Where are you? She told him, and he responded by telling her in great detail what he had enjoyed that night at dinner. I should go, she said. Yes, he agreed. When she emerged, the corridor was clear, but the firefighters had not yet arrived to scan the hallway. She pulled the dry erase marker from her purse and slipped the tip into the small black hole with the power jack at the bottom of the lock on the flight attendant's door. There was a satisfying pop as the bolt inside it opened. Then Elena slid into the room. Bowden had left the lights and the television set on. The drapes already were closed, which she deemed a lucky break. She was prepared to close them, but if she did, there was the chance that the flight attendant would notice the change the moment she opened the door and either retreat or shoot. This was one less worry. She surveyed the room carefully, noticing the open suitcase with the clothes rolled meticulously into tubes or folded and pressed flat. The woman may have been a mess in most ways, but she was one hell of a good packer. She saw the tin with Perugia chocolates on the dresser, the nightstand with her tablet and power cables, and the desk with a rather handsome pencil cup. It looked like the foot of an old Roman column. Like the vast majority of hotel rooms, the space was dominated by the bed, a queen with a faux headboard screwed into the wall. Most importantly, she noted the location of the two mirrors. As she was positioning herself just inside the doorway to await the flight attendant's return, the woman's bathroom to her left, she felt the movement before she saw it and tried to turn, but it was too late. She knew that and was more dumbfounded by her stupidity than horrified by the realization that she was about to die. Someone had entered Bowden's room when she had gone to the stairwell, when she had been drawn to the stairwell by the phone call from Victor. There was the strong arm around her neck, the crushing vice of the V of someone's arm against her larynx as he pulled her into the bathroom. There was the agony of the knife in her lower back, the peculiarly sonorous grunt of her own gasp. She knew, despite the incapacitating pain, what was next, and it happened in seconds exactly the way she saw it in her mind. He withdrew the knife and ran it across her throat. Instinctively, she tried to cry out, a reflex, but already she was gagging on blood. He had cut through the muscle and cartilage exactly the way she had with Alex Sokolov, and so all she heard was the small sound of someone gargling with mouthwash. And of course, this was not exactly the way she had executed Sokolov. He'd been asleep, sound asleep. In her last seconds of life, in the midst of all that pain and all that surprise, she despaired mostly that they were killing her when she was awake.
Chapter 32. Cassie stood in the crowd that had spilled out onto the street and the sidewalk across from the hotel and watched the fire trucks arrive and the firefighters race into the building. She was grateful that when the siren in her room had started to shriek and the alarm began flashing bright red, she had still been dressed. She had just started to doze off. She had just lost track of whatever was occurring on the sitcom. And so it had taken almost no time to slip into a pair of sandals and toss the gun into her shoulder bag with her passport and wallet and room key. She was glad this was August in Rome. It was the middle of the night, yes, but it was rather pleasant outside. She guessed there were close to 200 people milling about, none of them alarmed in the slightest, most in some version of night clothes or sweatpants. She was among the few women she saw in a skirt or a dress. For a moment she watched a gorgeous young couple nuzzling and grew at once envious and happy for them. The guy could pull off a Van Dyke beard without looking like Satan, and she was clearly naked, or almost naked, underneath a bright orange shawl she had wrapped loosely around herself. They noticed her gaze, and he smiled at her, so she quickly glanced down at her phone. She was scrolling through the spam that had come in when she heard her name and looked up. It was Michaela. She had climbed into a pair of black leggings and a white T-shirt. Cassie saw that she slept in braids. "Well, this is fun," the other flight attendant said, joining her by the streetlight where she was standing. "Were you asleep?" Cassie asked. "I was, sound asleep. I assume it's a false alarm." "Yeah, I do too. I don't see anything that would suggest there's a fire. No smoke, nothing." "Unless maybe it's something stupid and minor in the kitchen." "That could be." The woman leaned against the lamp post and surprised Cassie when she said, "It's times like this I wish I still smoked."
"You used to smoke?"
Michaela nodded. "I stopped when my husband and I decided we wanted to start a family."
"Was quitting hard?"
"Not at all. I thought it would be, but it wasn't. I just stopped. We said it's time for kids, and the next day, when I came out of an ATM before heading to the airport, I smoked what I knew was my last cigarette. There were 9 or 10 left in the pack, and I pitched them. I pitched my lighter. Of course, I'd always been a pretty casual smoker. I only started because of a high school play."
"You're kidding."
She rolled her eyes. "Nope, a raisin in the sun. I was Ruth, and the director had me smoking these stage cigarettes. They have chalk or something in them, so it looks like there's smoke. But I had no idea how to hold a cigarette.
So after rehearsal one afternoon, I bought a pack of real cigarettes to practice. It was kind of a drama diva move. When would you smoke?
You mean years later?
Uh-huh.
Usually at times like this.
Cassie raised an eyebrow.
Fire alarms?
When I was bored, or walking, or after sex.
Alex Sokolov was like that.
She hadn't planned to say it out loud. She wondered a little why she had.
The fellow who was killed in Dubai?
Yes. He only smoked when he was overseas in Europe or Russia or the Middle East. At least that's what he told me. Michaela seemed to take this in.
How well did you know him? I thought you only met him on the flight from Paris.
That's true. Not proud that I ended up spending the night with him, but yes, that is when we met.
Was he a good guy?
Cassie saw another member of the flight crew approaching, a fellow a bit older than her named Justin, who had pulled on a pair of blue jeans and a white Oxford shirt. At least she presumed he had gotten dressed again. She wondered if he often slept naked when he traveled, like some of her friends who flew, because it meant not packing pajamas. Or maybe his body ran hot, like hers, and he liked the feel of cool sheets against his skin when he fell asleep. Maybe he liked the erotic charge. Certainly some nights she did.
"Evening, ladies," he began. "Nothing like getting a good 2 hours of sleep before the alarm goes off. The fire alarm, that is."
"Nothing like it," Cassie agreed. And then, perhaps because she had reached a stage where she just didn't give a damn anymore about what people thought of her, she continued to answer Michaela's question. "Yes, Alex Sokolov was a good guy. At least he was to me. Maybe he was up to something. Maybe he was involved in something shady. I didn't know him well, and I probably drink too much to be trusted to judge anyone's character. But I liked him." She turned to Justin and explained, her voice as deadpan as she could make it. The tone, she supposed, of a woman who knew all she may once have hoped for in life had now passed her by. "We're talking about the man I slept with in Dubai, the one who was killed in our hotel room. Excuse me, his hotel room." Justin took this in for a split second. Then he put up his arms, his hands flat and framing his face, the universal sign for surrender.
"I can stand right over there if you two would like to speak privately. Far be it from me to interrupt," he said lightly.
"No," Cassie continued. "I don't seem to have any secrets anymore." As soon as the sentence had escaped her lips, however, she knew it wasn't true. It wasn't true at all. In some ways, it was the worst kind of lie because it suggested that her secrets and lying were behind her. But of course, she was just living a different set of secrets and lies.
"Did you, I don't know, think it was going to go anywhere when you were back in America?" asked Michaela.
"My thing with Alex? Not really. But we did have fun that night. Maybe we would have seen each other again. Maybe not." She put her phone back in her purse, sliding it in beside the pistol. "Given my history, most likely not." Justin looked uncomfortably down at his sneakers. They all noticed that he hadn't bothered to tie them, and so he knelt down. And Cassie imagined he was probably grateful to have something to do that did not involve listening to her discuss the sad end to her dalliance at the Royal Phoenician. "My vice has always been drinking," she said now to Michaela. "I never smoked. I'm not sure I could quit drinking the way you just stopped smoking. Hell, I know I couldn't."
"Were you drinking when the fire alarm went off?
Alone in the night in the hotel room with a bottle of tequila? That could be me, but it wasn't. Not this time. I haven't had a drink all day. Or night."
"There you go. You're fine,"
she sighed. "No, I'm not fine, Michaela. I'm not fine at all. You saw me at the airport this morning."
Justin stood up and said, "What happened at Fiumicino had nothing to do with drinking. You were sober, Cassie."
For a moment, they stood in silence, and Cassie had the sense that he wanted to embrace her, to comfort her, but was afraid it would be construed as something less chivalrous.
I mean, you were sober, right?
Yes, she answered. I was.
There you go.
They watched two firefighters exiting the front entrance, followed by a gentleman in a black suit and a necktie, the luminescent red of a New England maple leaf late in September. First in Italian, and then in English, he asked for everyone's attention. He introduced himself as the night manager and apologized profusely for the inconvenience of what was, happily, just a false alarm. He said everyone could safely return to their rooms or, if they preferred, first to the hotel bar, which was going to reopen for an hour for anyone who would like a nightcap, on the house. A free drink, he explained, was the least the hotel could do to apologize for dragging everyone out of bed in the middle of the night.
I'm game, said Justin. What about you two?
But Michaela glared at him, her dark eyes daggers. Cassie couldn't miss what that stare meant. I think we should all just go back to sleep, she told him. No, it's fine, Cassie said. It really is. I won't join you, but if you two want to go, please don't let me put a damper on the party. Instead, Justin shook his head and said sheepishly,
You're probably right, Michaela. Wheels up will come a lot sooner than we think.
Yes, it will. And with that, the three of them returned to the hotel lobby and rode the elevator together, all of them exiting on different floors, Cassie the last to leave on the sixth. No other hotel guests left with her on her floor. She guessed they were all at the bar. When she got out, she stood for a long moment and stared down the corridor. The hallway wasn't as opulent as the Royal Phoenician, nor was it as long, but it was elegant, perfectly appointed for a lovely Italian boutique hotel. The carpet was a little frayed with age, but the patterns were reminiscent of a Renaissance tapestry. She thought of the clouds and sea in a Botticelli painting and imagined the work that went into making a color or dye 500 years ago, the transformation of the pigments into the acrylic at the tip of the brush. Then she started down the hallway. She felt a spike of unease, but she had lived with almost that sort of twinge since she had woken up beside a corpse, and so she disregarded it. She walked in silence down the corridor, lonely and alone, her room key in her hand, and stared straight ahead. She told herself that the air was not really charged, and there was really nothing to fear, no reason to be morose. She was just going to a hotel room in the night by herself, as she had hundreds of times in the past. And there was no reason to be anxious or frightened. After all, this time she was actually sober. When that realization came to her, she smiled. But the smile didn't last long, because when she turned the corner, she saw a man, and she jumped. For a split second, she feared that her anxiety had a specific cause. It was every woman's fear when she's alone and sees a man in her path. He was about 20 yards from her room, and she almost turned and ran. But then she realized that it was only Enrico, and she relaxed. He was sitting in a small chair against the wall, his face in the shadow from the sconce behind him. There was a table with a hotel phone next to him. He stood when he saw her and went to embrace her, but she pushed him away. "You just scared the you-know-what out of me," she told him.
"I thought I would be a nice surprise," he said, his tone apologetic. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to scare you."
"God, it's best if I'm alone, Enrico. I told you that."
"And I was going to leave you alone. I was down at the bar when the fire alarm went off. I was helping them close, and I thought my beautiful flight attendant must be terrified."
"By a fire alarm? No." He shook his head.
"By being outside in the dark, instead of safely in bed in your room."
"I'm back now. I'm fine."
"Then I will escort you to your room and leave you there."
He held out his elbow, and she took it. Together they walked down the corridor. Then she slid her key into the slot and opened the door.
Chapter 33. He had just finished dragging Elena's body into the bathroom and dropping it into the bathtub when he heard Enrico's voice in the corridor. It didn't give